There are a few seats left down here. And one over here, some in there, and one here. We have a phonograph record back in my house, which is Basil Rathbun's reading of the piece that you all know about, Peter and the Wolf. Maybe some of you have heard it. The part that I like about best of all is about in the middle of this, after he's got all of these complicated things set up, in this beautiful voice of his, he says, "Now let's see where things stand." And then you get it laid out. So I'm going to start that way this morning. Where we stand at the moment is that I now have said what I want to say by way of background, and I no longer claim King's X. You can cross-examine me at any point from now on, and all you have to do is flick a wrist at me, and I'll stop and argue or entertain questions or comments of any sort that you like. In terms of where we're going in the next couple days, today we want to talk about poverty, welfare programs, and this sort of thing. Paul introduced a little bit of this yesterday. Tomorrow morning, I have a desire to set up a thing about fairness in business as a lawyer sees it, what it means to try and regulate the competitive process, unfair competition. I'd like to talk a little bit about the great sandpaper shave case. Rapid Shave outshaves them all, or whatever it is that, you know, you can shave sandpaper with our product, the Palmolive Colgate case, which just went through the United States Supreme Court and is a fascinating illustration of metaphysics, what is reality, and is a wonderful illustration of how law works in this area, and we can use it. I want to do that tomorrow morning, Thursday, in order that Paul Hain, who is going to be on deck again Friday morning, will have a chance to shoot back at me. I've been unfairly following him and sort of gunning at him after he is out of circulation for the rest of the day. That's a safe way of doing it. So now we're going to reverse that process. Friday morning, we are very fortunate in having with us Larry Mathry. Larry? Mathry? Who, stand up a minute, will you? Let these people see you. A chaplain, pastor. He is a chaplain at McNeil Island, which is the federal penitentiary here. And he's only going to be here until Friday noon, and I would like very much to share my time with him on Friday morning, where we will have 15 minutes apiece to take care of the first half an hour, in which we will talk about crime and punishment, not as Dostoevsky knows it, but as Ritti and Mathry know it. I, from the point of view of the lawyer who puts him away, and Chaplain Mathry from the point of view of the chaplain who lives with them after we've got them behind walls, and jointly how society ought to handle this problem. So that's where we're going. Now, this morning, immediately, the process that I'd like to follow is this. In about eight lines, I would like to put in a capsule what I've talked about the last 2 days, at which point I will break, pause, and let you cross-examine if you like, hopefully getting that process out of the way by about 10 o'clock, and then digging into poverty for the balance of the half-hour period. I have tried to say that law and justice is not the ideal relationship between God and man, nor between man and man. Rather, the ideal relationship which exists in God's plan for humanity is the transforming power of the God's love, his constraining love upon us, which is the fire on our heads that Paul talks about in the 12th chapter of Romans, which actually God has upset our cognitive balance, you see, by asking of us as his created beings, only love in response, and when we gave him, instead of love, insurrection in the fall of man, and with every reason to expect only retaliation from God, this being the natural order of things to retaliate, instead God responds with love that includes ultimately even the sacrifice of his son. This sort of upsetting of the normal expectations is so disturbing to me as a Christian that if I see it and observe it, the result is that I simply am constrained to react to God. Now, if this same transforming power can be put into my life so that I also can become a transformer of other human beings by doing the same thing, not returning evil for evil, but returning good for good, this again upsets the cognitive the balance, the expectation, the natural order of things, and it would make me truly a Christian transformer in the world. The difficulty is, of course, that I am not God, and I am not able to reflect accurately living under condemnation this transforming power, and so, if I can put it briefly, it doesn't work. Rather, I live under a judgment which makes it impossible to attain this sort of panacea, this utopia, and God then gives me the very good gift of his law, which makes it possible for me to live in a less than perfect world and a less than perfect setting. Law is not an ideal. Law is a very uncomfortable compromise where we have to give and where we have to take, where we have to settle with imperfection, even in the face of our knowledge that it is imperfect. And justice is not, to me, a beautiful thing in the sense that God's love is a beautiful thing, but only in the sense of beauty. Justice is beautiful only in the sense that it enables one human being to live, no matter how haltingly, with another human being. Law is never a substitute for knowledge. It is never a substitute for Rudy, who can, as a scientist, demonstrate how certain things can be done. Whenever science can answer a problem for us, you don't need law. Law is simply the alternative that we ultimately come to where the answer to a problem which must be decided is not knowable. Where you cannot know what the answer is, but you must decide the problem. That is the place where man uses law, because it gives him a systematic approach to resolving the irresolvable. Maybe not the scientifically correct answer, but this is not within man's grasp. And in the meantime, he has to use this other process, which is the legal process of resolving the thing. Therefore, the resolution of the problem in itself becomes a good thing because it enables man to live together. It may not be a scientifically correct thing, if you see what I'm saying. The ball which the pitcher throws to the catcher and goes over the imaginary base is not a ball or a strike, either one. No matter where it goes, it is not a ball or a strike until the umpire calls it. Now, his calling of it is guided by certain standards we call the imaginary strike box. But if the ball, in fact, scientifically went inside the imaginary box, and the umpire, in honest statement, as he saw it, said strike, it is not that he was erroneously calling a strike, if he's called it a ball, I'm sorry. It is not that he is erroneously calling a strike a ball, because that pitch was never a strike. It was always a ball. Because in this kind of thing, what the man says it is what it is. And you can do this only in those areas in which you can't know scientifically. So law is no substitute for knowledge. It is a way of resolving problems in order that we can mush forward together. Law is much closer to violin playing than it is to geology. That is, it's much more of an art than it is a science. And this is one of the reasons why I constantly am getting persecuted at my own school by my colleagues who like to think of themselves as being scientists. But at least in the context in which I have just put it, it is a way of living together systematically rather than absolute knowledge. That's what I've tried to say the last 2 days. Now, are there problems here before we go on? Yes.
Sometimes the umpire, we will say, the umpire will admit after the game, I do.
Yes.
I called it a ball, but it was really a strike. Or coming back.
Well, I called it a ball. If my perception had been more accurate of the actual physical facts, I would have called it a strike.
But isn't he saying now that there is some standard beyond my calls which judges my calls?
There is a standard which enlightens my decisions and which I try to apply. I'm trying to see them physically accurately. And I, as a judge, am enlightened by this standard which has been created for us by either legislation or by common law, and you remember this discussion. And as the judge, the guy who has the say, and who's going to be respected because I've got the muscle to put it into order, I try and make my decisions according to these standards. But the fact that I am wrong does not destroy the validity of what I've said. It's still the decision with which we have to live.
All right, now the question that follows. We use the phrase an unjust law. What would you understand? Are we talking nonsense when we talk that way? What does that mean?
It means something. To me, it means a law which is either in violation of a goal, may I call it now a moral goal or a spiritual goal, which we're trying to attain, and which we now say is simply basically unenforceable. This is not the kind of thing that ought to be forced upon us. This is the point at which we have the right to revolt, ultimately. And I'd like to talk about this someday before we part, I hope, civil disobedience, because it's another big problem. It also means an unjust law means one which doesn't work well, and which is so constantly out of phase with what society needs that it now is not a good law because it isn't a useful law. Therefore, we ought to get rid of it.
With that first point, I switch this. That first notion of an unjust law, it is incompatible with the goal toward which we are striving.
The goal which has been...
But we're assuming that our goal is just.
Not just. This is a poor word, unjust, because it carries too much freight for us to use it cleanly. Now we've got to go back and look at that idea again that we started with. We are not saying that our laws are established for us as being perfect, absolute, and immutable. This is the concept of natural law, which I, for myself, must reject. Nor are we saying that we can live in a world like Hans Kelsen's world, where everything is a matter of sociological testing, that there are no ultimate rights and wrongs. Rather, because we are human beings living under condemnation, we must recognize that we've got a tough row in the middle, and that is that we never do grab, and we are never able to fully implement perfection, absoluteness. We're never ultimately right, you see. We're constantly in error, although we can never afford to let our doubts about it freeze us. So we've got to act even in the face of knowledge. Luther all over again. I'm aware of the fact that I'm going to sin, but God has assured me that I'll be forgiven, and so I'm able to sin with confidence of God's forgiveness, this type of thing. Now, in that context, you must admit that this is a relative thing, and that there are standards which are absolute. God's love, the humanity of man, this kind of thing. But these are not things which we will ever be able to implement fully. Therefore, we strive toward these goals that we can more or less make concrete for ourselves, never attain. This is the thing which enlightens our compromising legal actions down here. More on that when we get into welfare this morning. That will show through, I think, almost like Rudy's outcropping of tougher kinds of rocks, because that does project through at you constantly when you get into specific illustrations, specific applications of the law. Yes, sir.
You speak of the Sermon on the Mount as a harsh, unattainable goal of law.
Yes.
Could maybe just more be the facts of life.
If by facts of life you mean the inability of a man to do those things which he knows he ought to do, of which he is aware that he ought to do, the harshness that I refer to is the fact that if one looks at the Sermon on the Mount as being an offer from God, do these things, and you will have salvation, then this is a completely unfair proposition which God is making you, because we're lost before we start. We simply can't.
Thou shalt do these things, or thou shalt not do these things. It's just a simple description of life as it is, it seems to me.
It is. That's right. It's an accurate statement of the fact that man is unable to accomplish these goals. This is what he ought to do. Now, if you think of it in terms of God's offer to us, it isn't unfair in the sense that it's more than God has a right to expect. Obviously, he does have this right. But it's unfair if you think of it in terms of, does the person to whom it's addressed ever have a fighting job, a chance to accomplish it?
It seems like within it, the punishment fits the crime.
Ah.
That it isn't unattainable, harsh.
All right, so you're talking.
You judge not, and you'll be not judged. Or, mm-hmm. or like so many writers and gifted people have picked up some of these simple statements and clarify them in just simple fairy tales. Just a Cinderella is humble and she scores.
Yeah.
Trouble with. Like it's just the facts of life, unattainable.
Trouble with them is that they are simple.
Yeah, they're just so simple.
And life isn't. And they don't fit.
Well, they're just hard to believe. They're so simple.
Yeah, and it's good that we don't believe them, because when we do, we deceive ourselves. We can't attain our goal this way. You see, you're talking awfully good law right now. Let the punishment fit the crime. This is a striking example of man's sense of justice. He did it. That's what he merits. That's what you give him. And if one really believes this, you see, if what you merit is what you get, then you can't say that you've been dealt with unjustly. You've had all of the regular due process, and that's justice. That is precisely what man cannot live with. Because if man must look God in the eye and say, give me exactly what I've got coming, what a horrible thing to say to God, because you know what you're going to get.
What we do live with, the golden rule isn't inexorable, harsh lives, just it turns upon itself. Do unto others as they will do unto you. It's just it turns upon itself. It's a fact of life.
I can buy this. It is a fact of life. The fact of life is original sin. This is what you must do. Do it. I can't. Now then, have you been dealt with unjustly? No.
It doesn't say thou shalt, or thou shalt not, or that there will be
do unto others.
Punishment. It's just that do unto others. And
do unto others.
As they will do unto you. It turns upon itself.
Well, I read do unto others as a prescription. Do this. If you want to read it the other way, whatever he does to you, you do that back to him. That, if anything, is worse. Because this leaves out any hopes of getting up over the top of the lowest common denominator. And that, again, is something that I think will show through as we get into poverty this morning. Well, let's take a whack at it, and as I say, from now on out, just if you have a question, just pop up your hand, and we'll take it right away. I'm used to taking on real giants around here, like Paul and other people. This morning I have a smaller man to pick on, but he's a good one to start with. If you've ever read this subversive document, which is called Peace on Earth, is the thing which I use to get my dander up today. This, of course, is the statement by Pope John. maybe it isn't fair to pick on a guy when he's not here to defend himself, but he's got friends. I start out now with the concept that we do agree that James knows what he's talking about when he says that pure religion undefiled is to visit the widow and the orphan in their affliction, keep oneself unspotted before God. This concept of welfare, charity, call it what you like, is significant. Has been always. The poor have been with us always, of course. Always will be. Poverty is a very, very relative thing. We took a minute or two to try and define it yesterday morning. That's long enough to demonstrate that it's almost beyond description. It can be the man who earns less than $3,000 in the city or $2,000 on the farm in the United States, and that guy can be immensely wealthy if you compare him to the many people who are born and live, die without ever having a full stomach. And of course, there are many, many such people. I agree with what Paul said yesterday, that one gets a untrue picture of the Middle Ages if you think of everything as being the grand old days and rosy. That was not true. Rome in all its glory was still the place where a fraction of the people enjoyed any kind of civilization. And not a night went by in Rome, as you probably know, without having 40, 50, 60 newborn babies laid out in the public square, either to die from exposure or else to be picked up to be slaves or brought up as prostitutes or whatever anybody wanted to do with them. This was Rome and at the height of its development. We at least are beyond that. And it is true that we do develop. We bring nature under our dominion. And man in this sense is making things, quote, better. And I hope that by this time you're learning what I mean by saying that it's better. It alleviates man's suffering and it enables us to live together more efficiently. It is not an efficient cause for our salvation, but it's a good thing in terms of our life together. Now, starting with that idea, where I want to try and get now is, how do we set this into motion? How do we express our Christian charity, this goal, in our daily lives? Pope John, in his statement, says this. First of all, he says, how strongly does the turmoil of individual men and people contrast with the perfect order of the universe? It is as if the relationships which bind them together could be controlled only by force. But the Creator of the world has imprinted in man's heart an order which his conscience reveals to him and enjoins him to obey. This shows that the obligations of the law are written in their hearts, and their conscience utters its own testimony. Then skipping over a little bit, he gets down to a part one, order between men. Every man is a person with rights and with duties. First of all, it is necessary to speak of the order which should exist between men. Any human society, if it is to be well-ordered and productive, must lay down as a foundation this principle, namely, that every human being is a person, that is, his nature is endowed with intelligence and free will. By virtue of this, he has rights and duties of his own, flowing directly and simultaneously from his very nature, which are therefore universal, inviolable, and inalienable. That, of course, sounds something like our own basic documents in the United States. If we look upon the dignity, I'm reading further now from the Pope's statement. If we look further upon the dignity of the human person in the light of divinely revealed truth, we cannot help but esteem it, that is the dignity of the human being, far more highly. For men are redeemed by the blood of Jesus Christ. They are by grace the children and friends of God and the heirs of eternal glory. Beginning our discussion of the rights of man, we see that every man has the right to life, the right to bodily integrity, and the means which are necessary and suitable for the proper development of life. These things which you have a right to. These are primarily food, clothing, shelter, rest, medical care, and finally the necessary social services. Therefore, a human being also has the right to security in cases of sickness, inability to work, widowhood, old age, unemployment, or in any other case in which he is deprived of the means of subsistence through no fault of his own. By the natural law, capital N, capital L, by the natural law, every human being has the right to respect for his person, to his good reputation, the right to freedom in searching for truth, and in expressing and communicating his opinions, free speech, and in pursuit of the arts within the limits laid down by the moral order and the common good. And there he's beginning to fudge like crazy. And he has the right to be informed truthfully about public events. The natural law, capital N, capital L, also gives man the right to share in the benefits of culture and therefore the right to a basic education and to technical and professional training in keeping with the stage of educational development in the country to which he belongs, and continues in the same way. The basic difficulty with this statement, as I see it, is that a man has no right to any of these things. Against whom does one have such a right? And what do you mean by a right? If the relationship between man and God was only and basically a matter of law, a matter of justice, then you could talk in terms of rights. And you could say that God owes me certain things. Now, to a lawyer, a right means this correlative thing of, I have a right to have this, and somebody has a duty to let me have it. For example, if I am a landlord and you are my tenant, I have a right to have the rent and you have the duty to pay it to me. I have the duty to let you occupy the premises and you have the right to have it. Now, is it conceivable in your minds that a person can say to God, God, you owe me these things. I have a right. And if my life is taken from me, if I do not have enough food, if I do not have enough clothing, if I do not have enough shelter, if I do not have an education which I need, if I do not have the necessary social services, you, God, have failed in your duty to me. To me, this is completely inconceivable. I cannot see the relationship between God and man in this light. Now, it is true that God has, by his own promise, covenanted certain things, and I believe that his covenant with me will not be broken. But a covenant in this sense is God's promise, which is made binding upon God only by God. That is precisely the meaning of the word covenant in the old ancient law. A covenant was not an exchange of my word in exchange for something from you to me, but it was my statement and then I sealed it. And at the old common law, the seal, my seal, my bond was the only thing that made this enforceable. Sir?
Would you make a distinction between, I would agree with you that you look at it in terms of right, no, but if God's intention, would you...
God intends well for me.
Does God intend these things?
God loves me.
He intends these things for me.
God will give me these things. And I believe this. But he does not owe them to me. The relationship which exists between God and me is one of a man who is going to give me by grace that which I do not merit. And for me to say to God, you owe me this, and you must give it to me, or you violate my rights, is, I think, blasphemous, if I may say so. And with all due respect to the author, I'll turn the book over. I think that this is simply blasphemous to regard the relationship between God and man in terms of what man is entitled to demand from God.
Are you going to be unfair to Pope John?
Perhaps.
I would assume he's thinking in terms of intention. God intends.
I don't believe so. I think that Pope John starts from the position that the Church has started from historically, and that is one of natural law, capital N, capital L. And the rethinking of this doctrine is going to be a much more painful thing for the lawyers in the Catholic Church and the lawyers in the Protestant Church than it will be for the priests in the Catholic Church and the pastors in the Protestant church.
This is Thomas Aquinas' theology over and over again.
I'm in favor of ecumenicity. I think it's wonderful. But you pastors and priests are apt to arrive at it intellectually long before we lawyers are, on the basis of the terms of natural law or Kelsen or the American proposition that we've been discussing. Sir?
It doesn't make it much better, but is this a demand of God or of man?
All right, that's the next step. If it is not of God that we have a right and a power to demand, is it then that we are talking about not the relation between God and man, but between man and man? That one man owes to another man, and that each human being has a right to demand of his fellow human beings the basic ingredients of life, that is, food, shelter, necessary education, and so forth. Is it now true, not on God's level, but on man's level, that such a right exists? What do you mean by a right? A lawyer means, when a lawyer says right, he means, I am entitled to this under our laws. If you do not give it to me, I will go into the courtroom and I will say to the judge, Your Honor, this person who owes me the rent for the room has not given it to me. And the judge will then say to that person, Is it true that you have not given the man the rent that he owes? He'll say, No, I'll prove it is. And when I've carried my burden of proof and have shown that this tenant has wrongfully refused to pay me the rent which the law says he must pay, the judge will then say to the policeman, Make him pay it, or permit this man to take it away. That is what a lawyer means by right. It is enforceable. Indeed, Holmes went so far as to say, without a remedy, in the absence of a remedy, there is no right. In the absence of remedial possibilities, if you can't enforce it, if you can't get the policeman to go out and take it away and give it to you, you don't have a right. That's talking now just about man's law, one man's dealing in law with another. If this is true, is it true that the starving peasant in India has a legal action by which he can come to me and say, Riki, you've got two cars, sell one and give me that money. And if I say, no, I won't, may he then take me into the courtroom and say to the judge, Riki has two cars, he won't sell one and give me the money, make him do it. He has no legal right. Now, he may morally have an expectation which may be morally justifiable, and morally he may rightly anticipate that I, in love, should willingly sell one of my cars and give him that car. This may be a proper moral expectation. And in terms of morality, I may feel a constraint because of the love of God which is in my heart to sell my car and give him some money. But this is not legally enforceable.
Well, you're saying that the laws don't exist for this. If this is a relationship of man to man rather than man to God, it's not possible because the laws don't exist. It might not be pushing for these laws to be made.
Excellent.
There might not be a monolithic system, though, to do it.
Precisely the point you see. Now, let's ask ourselves the question, shall we then set up, as a matter of our laws, either by legislation or by the development of common law, and may I assume now that you've got these things straightened out, the growth of law by case decisions and habits and customs recognized by society or legislation through the legislative bodies. Shall we now set up and make it a matter of positive human law that a person who is starving to death has a right to come in and take my property and feed himself? That a person who does not have enough clothes, and I have two sets, may come and take some. Shall we say this? Now we come to the place where we have to make those difficult, difficult decisions, you see, that Paul was talking about yesterday. What is the most efficient system? Paul, I think, was dead right yesterday when he says that had it not been for the voracious appetites of the robber barons of a century ago, who whipped through our country amassing huge fortunes and putting it back into factories to make more, that we would all be poorer in terms of wealth today than we are. Now that is a shocking statement, you see. question that we come to at this point is, does God really expect me to sell all that I possess and give to the poor? Is that what he wants me to do? Is it? Or does God say to me, look, I have given you certain wealth, and I expect you to use your head to build factories, to say to the guy on the street, I see you're starving to death. I'm sorry about that. I have lots of money. I'll tell you what I'm going to do with that money. I'm going to build a factory, and it's going to take me 3 years. And then out of this factory are going to come some food and clothing and stuff for shelters. And then I'm going to make everybody in the world richer. Of course, you will be dead by that time from starvation. But I'm going to do it anyway, because this is, on the long haul, the most efficient basis of doing something. Now let me tell you that I have personal interest here. I have just completed, pardon the personal reference, but I'd like to tell you why I feel as strongly about this as I do. I've just completed, with some other persons, a year and a half study of the welfare system in the state of Washington. The legislature in our state appropriated $100,000 for this, and we studied extensively over a year and a half all of our welfare operations. And as of, I suspect, yesterday morning, or perhaps this morning, the governor of the state has probably released an announcement that I am now the chairman of the state's advisory committee on public welfare for the state, which means that I have a very deep personal interest in what I'm talking about at the moment. I am fully convinced that it's only in the harshness of law at this point that we're going to be able to execute the warm-hearted Christian principle, which I think we all share here as our goal. Illustration. Some of you in the audience are medical people. How do you get rid of a disease? Malaria, I think, is a pretty good illustration. At least in our country, it's pretty well gone. If one treats malaria and develops better and better and better treatment for malaria, so that every time you find somebody with malaria, it isn't very long before you can cure him, I assume that you never get rid of the disease. What you have to do is to go find out why people get malaria. Interrupt the cycle, the breeding cycle of the mosquitoes. Take care of it at its source, its cause, and get down below, get at the causative factors of this thing. This may mean that there are a lot of people who die of malaria in the interim, because human resources in brains and money are scarce. You can't treat everybody's problems at the same time. We simply do not have this capacity. So you have to make your decisions as to where you're going to use it and the way in which you are going to use it. What would a proper system, a proper allocation of priorities be in welfare, for example? Alleviation. Alleviation is the one that we have paid most attention to in the world. That is, just feeding the hungry and clothing the unclothed and sheltering those who have not yet been sheltered. I don't think that's the place to start. I think the place to start is with prevention in the first instance. And then, after we have spent as much money as we can spend on prevention, then on rehabilitation of those people who can be rehabilitated. And then finally, if there's anything left, on alleviation. And to do that takes a sort of a harshness that most human beings don't have. And yet it is the efficient thing to do ultimately. The church, I think, is the conscience of society. It looks out and it sees the suffering which exists, and it cries for some sort of remedy for this harshness. But the church must also recognize that it in itself is not competent. Now, I use that term now in the sense of not enough people, not enough money, not enough tools to do the job which has to be done in society. Rather, it must turn to the most effective tool that it has, and indeed it's the one that God gave us for this very purpose, that is government, and use it in order to accomplish the results that we'd like to put together in a poverty program. Now, this is literally fraught with all sorts of hazards. Once you turn to the admitted imperfection and the sinfulness of a legal system and recognize that this is the place that you're going to do your work, you immediately run into a bunch of problems, which we tend to call dirty political maneuverings. And I think we best stop here and get that straightened out. If you're dealing with law, you are obviously not dealing with perfection. I trust I've made that point. And you're going to have to make some compromises. All sorts of things can happen. I would like to use two very ordinary illustrations of the kind of reason why it's necessary for a person with an informed Christian belief to get immediately, if he can, involved in the implementation of his own convictions, of his sensitivity to human needs, through the political machinery. Most budgets for most states are built on what's known as, this is illustration number one, are built on what is known as a line item budget. That simply means that if you're talking about the welfare program in the state of Massachusetts or California or Washington, that you may break this down into a number of lines. This one may be blind, this one may be mentally retarded, this may be people who are senior citizens and with no funds to support themselves, this may be aid to dependent children, this may be general welfare, this type of thing. This budget represents the appropriations which the state will make. And out here will be so many dollars for this one and so many dollars for each of the next things. Do you know, for example, that in our political machinery, that funds must be appropriated by lines for specific purposes? A budget is built 1 year before the legislature meets. Because things are appropriated by line, in order that we can watch where our money goes, if you simply put it all in one big pot and give it to the administrator, he's apt to divert it for wrongful purposes. It's good accounting theory, all right. But a year before the budget request goes in, the administrator must submit his budget for the following 2 years. That means he's guessing for a period 3 years ahead. And he must say that for aid to dependent children, I will need $1 million. And it will be divided between year one and two at $500,000 in each year. And in year one, it will be broken down by quarters, by $500,000, so much in each one of these quarters. Eight quarters projected 1 year in advance for each of 21 lines in a budget, in a welfare budget in my own state. If you guess wrong in any quarter, in any line, that amount of money reverts to the general fund. Now, in a normal business, one can accelerate his business expenses somewhat. You can always buy more paper or supplies or postage stamps. But have you ever tried to accelerate the birth of illegitimate children nine quarters away in order to take care of a wrong guess, you see, or slow down deliveries for a few months in order to get yourself within the proper budget item? As a result of this sort of political maneuvering, your legislator has been coming back to you and saying that the state of Washington needed $280 million. He's always appropriated $280 million for the needs which have been projected in the budget, and the state has never spent more than $260 million, and he's getting sick and tired of appropriating more money than the state needs for welfare. You know where the rest of that money went? Reversions back to the general fund. There has never been a time in any state when enough money has actually gotten out into the hands of the people who need it. But you see, watching only casually or superficially from the outside, buy this kind of thing without understanding what's really going on. The second illustration I'd like to give you, and there are obviously hundreds, literally, of this sort of thing. The second illustration I'd like to give of this same sort of thing is what you do with the money after you put it out there. Say welfare to almost anyone, and his response is, welfare is a fraud. People ought to have a little self-respect. They ought to be responsible for themselves. They ought to stop chiseling off society and go out and take care of themselves, like I'm doing. Or as the cartoon says, why don't you inherit your own? $1 million, yeah. 1930s, when government first got into welfare in a big way, we had a problem of a number of people who were temporarily thrown out of their normal means of occupation and livelihood by a rather dramatic upset in our national economic picture. These people were able to accept a job the moment it became available to them, and all that we had to do was create jobs. The welfare picture in the United States today is not that picture at all. 85% of the people on welfare in the state of Washington today could not accept a job if it were offered to them this afternoon. They are either too old, or they are too young, or they are too sick. They literally are unable to work. How did they ever get into that situation? Well, of course, birth and age are factors which are normal enough. Why aren't they able to support themselves or be supported by their parents? Because in too great a degree, we have perpetuated poverty by the very systems that we've used to try and eliminate it. We literally are breeding, through our poverty systems, our programs, the next generation's set of welfare recipients. And I say this without any malice in my heart at all. I don't mean to blame these people. This is simply the way that we have in our fumbling, inarticulate way of handling this problem, largely because of one central fact, and that is that we dislike these people intensely because we see them as being chiselers, as being lazy, as being unworthy. Have you seen The Sound of Music? That beautiful line in there where the trash collector, the father of the lovely young girl, My Fair Lady, the trash collector, the father, comes in and he wants $5 and he says that I am one of the undeserving poor. My needs for food are just as great as those of the deserving, and my needs for drink much greater. Here you have capitalized, if you will, an attitude which we must be able to develop toward these persons that we regard as being our welfare recipients. Because unless we can do something to bounce these people out of this situation, we are giving ourselves a completely impossible problem for the next generation. Do you follow me in what I'm saying now? I am making the kind of argument that I would make to a legislative body. We've never had such a successful year in the recent generations of man as we have the last year in Washington. This is an argument which even a pagan, heathen legislator can understand. This is going to save you dollars. If you interrupt this cycle right now, if you stop the breeding of poverty, in the long run, it's going to save you money. This is a law argument. This is an argument which is made to a man's pocketbook. This is an argument which is made to a man's hard head, not to his warm heart. And it comes out with more or less effect when you put it into action. Now I must illustrate this quickly. During the course of the investigation in Washington, those of us who were on the team decided to go out and see this situation for ourselves. We went out and knocked on doors, visited recipients, unannounced. Simply went up to people who were on the rolls and see whether or not they were really breeding more children in order to get more money. Incidentally, that's a losing proposition if there ever was one. But I mean from the recipient's point of view. We wanted to see ourselves, and I'd like to give you one illustration because I think it illustrates a lot of what I'm trying to talk about. This was in the town of Bellingham. Some of you know the city if you're around this part of the world. I got the address. The case was an old age assistance case and medical welfare case. I knocked on the door, and the lady came to the door. I said, I'm Bern Rieke. I'm here. We're doing a little study for the State Department of Public Assistance, and I'd like to ask you a few questions. She broke into tears. Now, I may not be Valentino, but I don't usually get this reaction. Yet you know as well as I do why she broke into tears. Why would a person connected with the State Department of Public Assistance be calling on a recipient? Why? What are the possible reasons? Dishonesty. You're cheating. You're a fraud. And we're trying to find some way of putting you in jail. Or you're chiseling and receiving too much, and we're here to see whether or not we can economize a little bit by taking you off the rolls. This woman also reads newspapers, see? And the newspaper story every time is about the chiselers. Do you know that in the investigation of 1,800 cases, we found not a single instance of defrauding in the state of Washington? Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't any. But it certainly means that they aren't rampant in the way that we've been taught to think about it, mostly because it doesn't make good economic sense. But this diverts from the point that I want to make right now. This woman is perceptive enough, and she's an awfully simple-minded woman, this gal. There's nothing wrong with her, except she was just incompetent, that's all. She'd been reared in a welfare family herself. She was a second generation. Her children, for the most part, are third generation recipients. She was perceptive enough, having read the newspapers, to know that the only reason the state would really come to her was to see whether or not she possibly was receiving more than she ought to receive, and whether or not somehow or other we couldn't knock her off the rolls and save a few bucks. Well, after I got the tears stopped, we started chatting for a few moments, and she told me what her problems were, and I won't bore you with them now, except to say that they are the problems that most people receive in the state of Washington, and in most states. My state's no worse than yours, I suspect. And that is, she was cold. She didn't have enough medical attention. We have all sorts of wonderful little mechanical problems. For example, a person in the state of Washington can get a very expensive operation on his eyes, but he can't get any glasses. We actually found accountants who had become ill and impoverished by bills during their illness, who were unable to get glasses, and so are perpetuated on our public assistance rolls month after month, although they could very easily go back to work and support themselves if the state would pop them to the price of a set of glasses. This is the kind of inefficiency that's built into this thing, and it's got its problems too. But back to the woman again. We talked for a little while, and she said she was cold. I understand that. You can only buy, the allowance is only enough for half the fuel that you need. She was inadequately housed, that's the truth. Finally, we got down to the fact that she was inadequately fed, and that's the place where I said that's impossible. No person in the state of Washington today needs to go hungry. You can just go down to the warehouse and get as much food as you like. And she said to me, oh, you mean surplus foods. I have never had anyone kick me in the stomach quite as hard as this woman kicked me when she said, you mean surplus foods. You know, all of a sudden, surplus foods to me stop meaning an act of love from society to our fellow human beings, and it started meaning slop. It's not even good enough for pigs. It is surplus. You know what the word surplus means? And how much of this kind of commodity, and she started listing the things which are available, how much of this can one really use and really eat? Then we talked a little bit about her family. Four children in this family. Three of them are welfare recipients because the state has blessed them with its welfare attentions from their birth until now and has carefully kept them from an education. You can't go to school without money, you know. Many kids drop out of school simply because they don't have the clothes to wear to go to school, or the clothes, the money that's necessary to buy bus fare. We carefully undereducate our poverty-stricken class so that they will be unable to have the type of education that's necessary to get along in the world. Carefully given too little nutrition, none of the social services essentially which are needed, except to perpetuate life and the ability to procreate. The fourth girl in the family happened to have the very good fortune of becoming illegitimately pregnant at the age of 13. This was enough to blast her out of the welfare system and throw her over into the juvenile court system, where she now was taken from this loving family. And I don't mean to belittle the family. The mother did love her girl, but was unable to do anything about it as a practical matter. and took the girl over where she was taken from her parents. The mother was deprived of this child, and the child was then put into a foster home situation. Child, her own baby, put out for adoption. The child then grew up in a foster home situation where she was given the normal treatment that a child gets, or at least something approximating it. Today, she is a happy, productive, well-adjusted member of society, happily married, she and her family earning their own way and contributing back to the good of human beings. If time were longer, which it ain't, and I'm going to stop in a moment, we could illustrate in literally dozens of ways how man's fumbling attempts to build into positive law, that is, we're going to legislate now, certain levels of assistance or certain levels of existence to which everyone is entitled, to which he has a right now by legislation. We could illustrate how difficult it is for us to do this when we approach it on a grudging basis, when we approach it only on the basis of what must we give this person. How much do we have to give them to keep them off our backs so that they don't die on the streets and clutter up the gutters? If this is the attitude which society has to its fellow human beings, our welfare laws are going to inch along painfully, if ever, to the place where we overcome our problems. And they are tremendous. They are tremendous. Almost half of the population of my state today are children under the age of 18 years of age. And we haven't even begun to see the problems that we are going to get as this generation. 85,000 of them next year will be contacted by public agencies. This problem is then mushrooming to the place where you must develop in your hearts a hardness and the ability to watch a person perhaps starve while you, by proper techniques, prevent causations of this sort of problem. That leaves out an element, doesn't it, of love. And we would like to think that back in the church, somehow or other, there is the capacity to go the extra mile, and I think there is. This, however, is not a matter of right. This is a matter of Christianity. Now comes the question of whether or not Christianity is all heart and no brains, or whether or not one Christian's attitude toward another one is also partly an intellectual process. Would you really be helping your fellow man if you gave away everything that you possess to the poor and leave yourself impoverished too? Would you really be helping your fellow man? Or is it better for you, when you leave Holden, to go back to a nice, comfortable home, well heated, plenty clothes, plenty food, automobiles to drive, nice, comfortable existence, in order that you can build strength to help your neighbor by perpetuating your own life? That, my friend, is a line that you have to draw. How much do you really need to keep for yourself in order to produce most efficiently? And do you have the moral strength that it takes to draw that line and to give away what you don't need and keep what you do need, even in the face of another man's starvation? That's not going to be a comfortable decision for you to make. You are a condemned person, saved only by God's grace. And the one thing that God doesn't give you right now is the comfortable decision. He gives you a painful decision to make. You rejoice in the knowledge that God's salvation is sufficient for you, and that even though in your decisions you err, and you let a man starve to death when you could have saved him, and that's a terrible sin, and you bear the responsibility for that man's death, God's grace is sufficient for the man who errs, but he must make the decision. That process can be aided somewhat by law. Beyond law, there still lies the Christian constraint in love to go the extra mile. Even it must be an efficient mile. Wish that we had a little longer to talk about poverty. Maybe over coffee somebody would like to beat me on the head with it. I'd be happy to do that. Tomorrow morning, though, we do start with unfair competition in the case of the great sandpaper shave.